Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control your own body and get the health care everyone needs has been stolen. And now politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect your right to control your own body and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, you can help reclaim your rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Here's an HIV pill dilemma for you. Picture the scene. There's a rooftop sunset with fairy lights and you're vibing with friends. You remember you've got to take your HIV pill. Important, yes, but the fun moment is gone. Did you know there's a long-acting treatment option available? So catch the sunset and keep the party going. Visit pillfreehiv.com today to learn more. Brought to you by Vive Healthcare.
Roses are red, violets are blue. Today is a special episode for you. Hello, I'm Sam Sanders, and a poet.
I'm Saeed Jones, and I'm being tested.
And I'm Zach Stafford, and you're listening to Vibe Check, National Poetry Month edition.
Yes, yes.
That's right. April is National Poetry Month. Obviously, this podcast, Vibe Check, officially is a fan of poetry, which I love and adore. For a while now, Sam has been like, we should do an all poetry episode.
Yes. I've had a gun to Saeed's head for a few months
like,
now.
I was like, no. He put that gun to my head, and I was like, Michael Jackson, just like, put the gun down. Let's just dance. Let's just dance.
But I finally wrote Saeed down, and he was like, oh, I have a friend I can call. And we're like, who's your friend? And he's like, oh, yeah, the National Poet Laureate.
Well, just casually.
I got casually. A deep bench. You know? I mean, but, you know, my friend Ada Limone is the U.S. Poet Laureate, which is to say, if you're not familiar, this is a role selected by the U.S. Library of Congress. I think the terms are usually 2 years. Sometimes they're like renewals. But it's this person who's appointed to be an advocate for poetry and to engage communities all across the country. And Ada Limone has been doing this since 2022. I'm also just a fan of her work and her vibe. She's very calm but mischievous, as you will hear in our conversation. And it's been a real joy to have her as both as Poet Laureate, but now as a friend of the podcast to talk about how we can kind of recalibrate our relationship to poetry.
And how to enter the world of poetry. I think a lot of people, myself included, our first introductions to poetry are very rote and didactic and off-putting. Yes. Ada in this chat has a lot of good guidance on how to just appreciate and like poetry.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. So what you're saying, Sam, is healing. We're healing today.
We're healing from some of our past traumas
like with poetry.
Yes. Yes. Sister Kathleen, I've never forgotten. Memorizing poetry. Oh, Lord. I hated it.
Well, but of course, before we get into the show, we always check in. Sisters, how we doing?
Well, this week, I'm feeling like an elder. Sam, I'm like you. I'm feeling older.
Don't you, Sam? I'm like,
you're drinking Ensure right now.
To be clear, Sam started when we logged into the Zoom. The first thing I saw was Sam being like, Saeed, look. And he was like holding up the Ensure.
It's my post-run drink.
Do you have some Ensure too?
No, I don't have any Ensure.
Or some Celsius. Are you on that stuff?
That's for kids. Celsius is not for me.
Celsius is really everything to me, but that's a whole other conversation.
I love it.
Why I'm feeling so old is on Friday, I went to a nightclub for the first time in years.
Oh, wow.
Me and Craig, it was Philip Bacardi's birthday. He got a table ran into lots of people at the club. And let me tell you, I used to be a club kid. If you know me well, like I, at 18, started sneaking into clubs in Chicago. I was really
Well, you
house
say you
music.
Were a journalist, right?
Yes. Before a journalist, I was like, my very first job was I was an intern on a documentary series that followed drag queens. And so I was
and
18
you just
with
go
a
in
camera.
The club.
And I would walk into the club. And that's why I learned is that if you had a job at the club, they let you into the club without showing an ID. I now do not want a job at the club. The club is too loud. There's too much like taking shots. There are young people who are singing songs that are older than them. That's really disorienting for me.
There's Gen Z kids that like that Keisha Cole song, Love.
Yes.
It's
that
really weird.
But anyway, I'm feeling okay. My age lately, and I definitely am feeling my age because Missy Elliott announced her tour. I think it's her
first headlining tour.
Ever.
I'm so excited.
I was at a SoulCycle class, I think, last week, and they started playing 1-2-Step with her and Sierra. And the SoulCycle instructor was like, I hope I'm not the only old person in here that knows every word to the song. And I almost fell off my bike. So I was like, old person, girl, that came out the other day. And I looked it up.
No,
it came out
didn't.
In 2003. So
yeah, girl.
20 plus years.
Yeah, girl.
We are aging. Our music is aging. And we are now vintage. So it's very.
Yeah, you get really thrown. I listened to Missy Elliott's album, Under Construction.
So good.
For the first time in a long time recently. And I was thrown because I forgot that it came out like right after 9/11. And also Aaliyah died like just before 9/11,
yeah.
A few months before. So it's really jarring when, yeah, these songs, you know, Missy Elliott, that sound, I just think it's a vivid part of like black life in particular. It's ageless and timeless. But on the intro, I mean, she's directly referencing Aaliyah and 9/11. And you're like, oh, it's been 20 years. Back. Oh,
yeah.
God.
Anyway, that's my vibe. Feeling old, but missing Aaliyah, I guess.
Yeah.
Mood.
You know, mood.
Sam, how are you doing? What's your vibe?
I have two little vibe check-ins. So yesterday was the eclipse. We're taping this on Tuesday. And I was out walking Wesley during the eclipse, and I saw all these Angelinos out and about. And my whole thought was just like, you know, people, you can go outside and look up in the sky and be nice to strangers every day. Don't let it just be the eclipse.
It's a special. Jesus
I'm
Christ.
Just saying, it was so interesting. Everyone's like, oh, we're out in nature and talking to people. The sun is there every day. The moon is there every day. Get outside. That's my first vibe. Second vibe.
Oh, my God.
And I want y'all's help with this because I can't interpret dreams. I had the weirdest dream last night. Can I tell you about it?
Yes, please.
I had the weirdest dream. So y'all know that I like Vegas. I don't gamble, but I go for the shows. I go to people watch. I go to eat the food. I love Vegas. I will drive there in a heartbeat. Just tell me when. But I had this dream that I had gone to Vegas, and I had parked my car in some garage underground, and I couldn't find my car. And then this really attractive man was like, I'll help you find the right elevator to get to your car. And he leads me around Vegas for like 40 minutes, and I cannot find my car. And the whole time he's like showing off, trying to impress me. And I'm like, what's going on here? I never get to my car. I get really frustrated. Then before I know it, this other man is like, I'll help you find your car. He can't help me find it. He's leading me here, there, everywhere. And before you know it, we end up waiting for his car and his two children. And he's talking to me about the custody battle with his kids. And then I still don't have my car. And I'm like, I have to go find my car. And then I keep looking for my car. I keep getting the wrong elevator. And then I woke up and I was really angry. And I have no idea what this means.
Sam, I have a reading for you.
I woke up viscerally angry.
Let's just go ahead and break this dream down. So cars symbolize independence and freedom. You began with saying, I like to drive to a place I love. So, you know, there's an act of you being with yourself and going somewhere we love is really important to you. However, when a man gets involved, you have this feeling in which you don't have that independence or that that kind of individuality anymore, and that it becomes all about them. And that even there's like a fear, so it sounds like subconsciously, that even like finding a man with children who may be able to create more independence or like stability in his own life for you, or, you know, sense of family, would also take something away from you to where you would lose something, you know,
girl,
in the pursuit of being with a man and wouldn't be able to get home. So that's my reading of it.
Okay. Okay.
My reading of your dream is, let's see.
Okay, don't be nice.
At the bottom
be
of
nice.
My bitch, you spending too much time on Grindr.
What is
you
this?
Out here hoeing on the highways and byways, and now it's all up in your neural pathways.
Girl, please.
Different men's taking you left, taking you right. You can't get out of the parking garage.
It wasn't sexual. It wasn't sexual.
You need to text on Betty.
Although, the first guy in the dream, if I recall correctly, the first guy in the dream gave a lot of Clay from Love is Blind energy.
I bet he did. I bet he did give a lot of Clay.
Any vibers out there listening who can help interpret dreams, any vibers who can interpret this with Zach, email us. Because I woke up from this dream angry. Anywho, Saeed, what is your vibe?
My vibe is that y'all might have noticed that, like, I came in like carrying books into the room. Mm-hmm. There are books. I need to come up with a system because for this chapter of the book I'm working on, I might be 12 books in for this one chapter, which this is just like never really happened where I'm kind of doing this level of research. So I'm deep in the archives and I guess I highly doubt I'm the first person. This is a realization for Saeed. This is not a realization for the world. I think many other people know this. But something I'm learning about history and culture, if you want to hide something from American culture, I'm convinced just put it in a book. And it will, with time, kind of disappear from the collective kind of memory because I'm just stunned at the things I'm reading. And, you know, like, for example, right now I've been like really honing in on the McCarthy era and the McCarthy hearings. And like, this is all documented. Yeah. It's all, many people have written about it. And I'm just, it's an exciting feeling. I think when you're doing research and you have one of those like, you know, or I didn't know, or wait a minute, this connect, like that's why we do the work. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to bring to my writing. But also, I guess what I'm trying to say is, and I wonder if y'all have felt this way. We've talked about, for example, Langston Hughes before and the way like his sexuality was suppressed, even by like his biographer. I found an article in like 1991 in the Los Angeles Times where his like official biographer refers to Langston Hughes as asexual. Which we know is untrue. Mm-hmm. And when I say untrue, it's like, baby, I have documentation of Langston's STIs. So he was having sex with somebody and he was not having sex with women. I don't know. I just always feel like when I'm in the archives and I discover something, quote, discover, it feels like I'm retrieving something that's in fact been stolen from me. Like, that's my vibe. It's like, it's this very emotional, like, why didn't I know about this? Shouldn't I know about this? Who kept this from us? That's where I'm thinking.
It's like, what are the spaces pre or post social media that were giving that kind of insight outside of books? Was it ever outside of books?
Right.
Was it ever outside?
Yeah.
You know? That's my question. Like, it's not like the History Channel 20 years ago was doing that stuff either. You know? They were hiding it too.
Yeah. And I would say my only contribution to this, because I feel similar feelings about archives as you're talking about, but I always kind of rationalize it as, if I ever find information about historical figures that share community with me that I didn't have before, I have a grieving process of realizing that, you know, my own body may not be looked at in history, may not be seen as valuable in terms of the historical landscape. And that's a really shocking thing because, you know, a lot of people who don't look like us get to open books and see their stories and see things that connect directly to them all the time. So when we find ours and have to uncover it in the archives, it just affirms the erasure of self.
And maybe, and weirdly, you know, it's like the next solar eclipse, I think, that we'll see with the kind of this totality or whatever is like 2045, which is, you know, a while from now. And I think when you start thinking more about mortality, you're also like, wait, so how will I be remembered? Yeah. Who will be in control of how I'm remembered?
And I think there's a larger thing that happens with big figures in history, particularly black figures in history, all kinds.
Yeah.
They get desexualized. You know, like Dr. King was a hoe. He was a hoe and a half.
And depoliticized as well.
Like his sexuality was stripped from him. There's something about the way history, American history, remembers black people of note. We can't see them as good if we also see them as sexual.
Yeah. I would say, we should do a whole episode on this. Because I would say any sexuality is erased from history books unless it's just about procreation. Because even like, there's an incredible book called Sex and the Founding Fathers by Thomas Foster. It came out like 10 years ago and it breaks down all the founding fathers. And they had very complicated sexualities, all of them. Not all queer, but all like non-normative in how we conceptualized them in the past. So I think like sex is erased in history. And why? And the kind of why is that is weird.
Yeah.
We're all having sex.
We're Puritan.
And maybe, I know I'm being very Sagittarius and like connecting a lot of dots, but thinking about our poetry conversation with Ada, which I think so many people's, if you feel you have a distance to poetry, my sense for the average American listener, that distance is created because of your relationship to poetry when you were being educated, Right. So this feels kind of similar. Like when I was in school, for example, I thought Langston Hughes' poetry was boring. I felt totally disconnected, but because it was how he was being taught in a very stripped away way. So I guess I'm just interested, whether it's about poetry or history, how can we return to these histories in terms of how they were presented to us with whatever hangups, erasures, censors, and like what can we salvage, retrieve to kind of change the way we think about, you know, these events and people? All right, before we get into the episode today, we want to thank all of you who sent us fan mail and reached out to us on social media. We absolutely love hearing from you. Keep them coming at vibecheck@stitcher.com. And don't forget, of course, can leave us a review where you're listening. And of course, check out our Patreon. It's been really fun chatting with people in the group chat. We got a lot of our questions today from Ada, in fact, from our Patreon group chat. So don't forget to subscribe.
Go to the Patreon and help me decipher my dream.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah, all right. For now, let's jump into our conversation with Ada.
Let's do it.
I haven't gotten to see you in a couple of years now.
I just want to hug you.
Your voice is a hug, Ada.
Oh,
your voice is a hug.
I miss you.
I miss you too. You know, I'm hoping to use this conversation to demystify poetry, to ground it. I think, you know, certainly, and we'll talk more about your work as poet laureate. I'm sure this is a lot of the work you're engaged in. To start, let's start with you as a student. Did you have a this is it moment for poetry, you know, as a student in particular, where you felt something kind of in the direction of your life change because of something you read?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a few of them. I was very lucky to grow up in a town that had this really great bookstore that opened across the street from the apartment I lived in.
Oh, okay. Where was this?
It's called Reader's Books. It's still there in Sonoma, California. And I walked across the street and asked for a job. And I said, I will never be late. I live right there.
That's a good pitch. That's a good pitch.
And I was able to spend a lot of time with all of the books. And my favorite thing to do was to pick poetry off the shelf and read a few poems, put them back, peruse at my leisure. And I feel like as much as I loved, I had some, you know, wonderful teachers and definitely had some experiences with poetry inside the classroom. I actually think it wasn't until I was sort of allowed to really dive in on my own and follow my own instincts and permission to put down a book that wasn't suiting me or wasn't helping me or didn't in any way speak to my own experience. And that was something that I didn't have in school, right? It felt like, oh, we are working on this poem. This is the poem we're reading. And that was the kind of freedom I think I needed to really get interested in not just poetry, the art form itself, but also the amount of different kinds of writers that were writing and the amount of different types of poems there were. And that was where everything shifted for me.
Yeah. It's funny because I hadn't quite connected the dots in the way you just explained, but, you know, I had pretty good experiences as a college student and even high school with poetry, you know, no poetry trauma. But in college, there was a time period where I spent a lot of time by myself, and I would just go to the library, and I literally be like, this is the Anne Sexton day or the Lucille Clifton day, and I would just sit down cross-legged and, like, one book at a time. And, yeah, can you say more about that? So it sounds like classroom's fine, obviously important for a lot of us for a lot of reasons, but the independence, and you said the right to say, I'm done with this book, or this isn't working. Why is that so important?
You know, I think one of the reasons is that I think of poetry very much like music. There's a lot of difference, of course, but you don't listen to one song, and if you don't like it, decide you hate music.
Good point. And yet.
But people often read one poem or have to, you know, elucidate a poem in school, and they decide that's it.
Yeah.
And so I think for me, just because of my personality and who I am, I think there's a lot of, I need freedom. I need permission to play. And so I could pick up a book and go, oh, I really like this poem. Oh, I don't like the next poem. And it's the same author. Interesting. you know, right. and just keep thinking, what do I like? What am I drawn uh-huh. to? What are the lines that I love? And I think that was really important for me to see it, that just because you could like poetry and not like every mm-hmm. single poem that was ever written.
Of course.
And, you know, not liking every single poem that was ever written didn't mean that you were never going to read another poem. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it allowed me to figure out my own stylistic tendencies, my own obsessions, mm-hmm. and the things that really ignited my own passion for not just poetry, but for a way of life.
That's so helpful. And gosh, I frankly hated so much of the poetry I was taught in yes. class. You know, I just like, it's not, yeah. you know, so much of that's just like not for me. But it's like, if you are reading widely enough that you're able to, I'm thinking like line by line, like literally just amassing enough lines of poetry or individual yeah. poems that your love is greater than the, you know, Wordsworth poems that you just don't like.
Yeah, and to allow yourself that kind of, to let a poem find you, I think that was yes. also very important for me, was that, uh-huh. you know, there are poets that I deeply disliked mm-hmm. when I was in graduate school or undergraduate mm-hmm. even, and I would think, I will never get this poet. I don't know, you know, what they're trying to do. Uh-huh. And then, you know, in my 40s, suddenly I was like, oh, I really like this poet.
I get it. Uh-huh.
You know,
you're
I'm
like, oh, okay, they're doing something. They're kind of cooking.
This is really yeah. interesting.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah. and I had to have a little more patience. And I had yes. to have a little more, honestly, you know, knowledge under my belt before.
Right. And life experience.
Yeah,
too.
And life experience. Mm-hmm. And so that was the other thing, was that no one knows where you are in your life when they hand you a book. And so it's yep. hard to kind of Ooh. Grasp and hold on to something that you want to love. Mm-hmm. But it may feel off-putting for numerous of reasons. And one of the reasons could just be timing.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, that's I mean, such a like if, to go back to the yeah. music analogy, how many times have you loved a song so much and then you go back to it a couple years later and go, just like, I mean, I still oh, like God. It. But why did I mean, I was yeah. obsessed with it.
Yeah. You're like, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
Did I even realize what the song was about? Yeah. yeah. Oh, that's such a good point. Well, so another angle in this kind of demystification effort is, I get the sense that people also feel that poets, I don't know where they think we live. I think they like we live on the sides of mountains, or like we're just like in the woods, maybe next to a volcano, like wherever Tilda Swinton is. I think that's, you know, like that kind of like, I don't know, y'all are just out there, and then books happen at some point, yeah. you know, yeah. where I think poets kind of exist in the American, at least, cultural imagination as pretty abstract.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, you mentioned your life, you know, in the bookstore in California,
yeah.
but you were also in New York City working at Condé Nast mm-hmm. at some point.
Yeah, for 12 years, yeah.
Yeah, so can you talk about that time of your life? Because I've always known you as, you know, Ada, my gal pal in Kentucky.
Yeah.
How did that switch come about?
Yeah, you know, I lived in New York for quite some time. I moved there for graduate school to go to NYU and quickly realized I needed a way of making an income.
Very expensive.
And yeah. So I actually had a temp job at GQ. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my first jobs in New York City. And from there, ended up to many different full-time positions throughout many different magazines, including Martha Stewart, Living, Brides, Modern Brides, Elegant Bride, many different brides. Uh-huh. And then ended my time there as the creative services director for Travel and Leisure magazine.
Wow.
And, you know, it was a time where I was putting out numerous books. I think that my third book, Sharks in the Rivers, came out. Uh-huh. In 2010, and that was the year that I ended up quitting those jobs.
Oh, okay. I think that might be right around the time I first met you.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so it was, you know, for me, a very interesting time because, like you were talking about, at least the American perception of where poets exist. And I do think there's a level in which they don't feel like we're real, right? We're
mm-hmm. I'm like, we go grocery shopping.
Yeah. Poets, they're just like us. and so I felt like it was also something I had a little bit of a bifurcated life where, you know, in the evenings I was doing poetry readings and going to poetry readings and writing poems and reading.
Yeah.
And during the day, sort of submerging that part of myself mm-hmm. Deep into the bottom of my shoes while I wrote copy. and I loved yeah. it. I actually really had a great job. I, uh-huh. you know, and it was enough money to get by in New York, which is very difficult uh-huh. to do in any job. But I definitely felt like my life was completely divided. And so in 2010, I decided that I was going to take the risk to see what it was like to write full time, as I know you have.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
that was, yeah, immediately I was like, I did not save enough money for this crazy adventure. What have I done? And so, of course, what I did was ended up, yes, writing. But what I ended up doing was, of course, freelancing for all the magazines I had worked mm-hmm. for prior to that move. So I moved to California. I was there for 6 months and then fell in love. Well, I was already in love, but was brought to Kentucky by my man. So
yeah, I always think of horses.
Yes.
Suddenly there's another horse. Well, so, you know, one thing I think about is one of the very few things the U.S. government has gotten right in decades is the U.S. Poet Laureate. Project. You've been serving since 2022. Before that's Tracy K. Smith, Joy Harjo, Juan Felipe Herrera. You know, I guess I wanted to ask, like, how has the reality of this job synced up with what you thought it would be like to be the U.S. Poet Laureate?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it's such a historical position holding so much weight and legacy. Like, I mean, Gwendolyn Brooks.
It's intimidating. It's a very intimidating list.
Very intimidating list. I think about her every time I'm in the Library of Congress office that is dedicated to the Poet Laureate. And I think this is where Gwendolyn Brooks held office hours. And I just hold that in my heart. You know, I just, I'm like, this is where, you know, Elizabeth Bishop wrote the poem Looking at the Capitol Dome. It's where Rita Dove, you know, wrote the poem Looking at Lady Freedom. Like, I mean, this is, I can see these things, and being a part of that legacy is such a really beautiful and overwhelming task in so many ways. I think for me, the thing that has sort of surprised me, perhaps, is that, you know, as an artist, and I know you know this so well, being one of my beloved poets, is that our job is to perceive, is to look, is to notice. And when the gaze turns on us, we usually put a poem in front of it or a book in front of it, right? We're like, I am promoting this book.
Yes.
I am reading you this poem. And as the Poet Laureate, you don't have the book in front of you. You're not promoting your book. Mm-hmm. It's not about your poems. You know, it is, but it isn't. It becomes how are you as a human being, an embodied person, going to amplify the power of poetry? What do you want to do? And it's a very interesting thing, because I think you do feel sort of stripped down, because we're so used to the protection of the work itself, the poem itself, the thing that we would do anything to make and create and devote ourselves to. And then suddenly it's like, oh, how do you want to talk about poetry itself? And that's been the interesting, kind of wonderful, because it's taught me a lot about my own feelings about poetry. Because I am someone who writes privately. I read privately. I think about all of these things of making art as a very sort of safe and sacred thing I do for myself.
Right.
And then here is a position that's like, hey, how do you want to talk about this?
Right.
And that's been really eye-opening. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe it. And even just, you know, even if the position wasn't poetry, I think any role that not just invites, but in fact insists upon you engaging the entire country would be transformative. Is there something, you know, and it could just be like an experience or an idea that you've come to understand based on your, you know, your work in the last 2 years?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple things. One is that I do have recognized, and I've always known this, but this solidified it for me, is that I am a private person and that I need to create a sort of self-protection and self-preservation in order to make sure that I keep writing and doing the work. Because as you know, most of us that write, we are literally writing to save ourselves.
Yep.
And if I am not doing it, I am not well. And so I think that actually advocating for my own well-being in the role has taken up some time, which I didn't expect. And it's been actually really affirming because I have now doubled down on boundaries and the things that I believe in and the way that I want other artists to feel the permission to protect themselves and to protect their own time. And then the other thing that really has surprised me and keeps coming up again and again is that I think actually there are more people out there that are doing the work of poetry, that love poetry, that are writing poetry all around the country. And I feel mm-hmm. like when you first get the job, there's a level in which like, I will bring poetry to the people.
Right.
And in reality,
I will sprinkle poetry upon these unknowing, you know, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And in reality, you get there and they're like, let me tell you the things that we're doing in our community. Let me tell you about our literacy program through poetry. Let me tell you about our, you know, poetry in the city park. Let me tell you mm-hmm. about, and there are more good people mm-hmm. doing the amazing work in grassroots organizations to bring poetry to everyone that mm-hmm. I have left places much more inspired and fueled up about the art form itself and the people behind it than I ever expected. And that to me has been just such a surprise and delight. And also a rethinking, because I do yeah. think there's a level in which we think, oh, if poetry sales are this, or if it's in the right. New York Times, it's this, you know. But there are a lot of places that poetry is, and it's surprising. And I think for me, it's been really affirming.
I love that. I love that. Well, I also want to, you know, in the spirit to point out that you kicked off April, which is National Poetry Month, by publishing a wonderful anthology, You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World. I know you well enough to know, and I was telling Sam and Zach, I was like, listen, it ain't a poem if an animal or nature, you know, even I love the poem, like you're in a mechanic shop and there's a pit bull,
yeah.
you know, and the pit bull yeah. becomes such an important part
of the
poem.
Car shop.
Yes, we love her. We love her. What a fierce poem. But I was wondering, you know, can you talk about specifically this anthology? Because it's also about the national parks, which is yeah. really cool, too.
Yeah, I was really trying to figure out the best way to come up with a signature project. And for those listeners who don't know, as the Poet Laureate, you are asked to do a signature project. They'd love for you to do one. You don't have to do one. but if you have met the incredible Librarian of Congress, Dr. Carla Hayden, she is an inspiration and a mentor. And she wants to do things as much as she can to bring in communities all over to have access to reading, to books, to the library itself. And so she's definitely like, I hope you do a project. And I wanted to do something that brought together poetry and nature. And I had lots of different ideas. As you know, mm-hmm. I'm enthusiastic about possibilities.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, oh, we could build a bridge over the Rio Grande made of poems.
Okay, work. Yes,
I said, oh, we could,
I
could fly a plane and I would drop poems on native seed packets to reseed deforested lands. I had lots of,
this is why you're my girl. This is why you're my girl. Ada's like, either we are changing the landscape or we're changing the goddamn constitution.
I was like,
get on it.
I was like, you want a signature project? I will bring you a signature project. But then, of course, I was like, how do I open it up and include as many people as I can? And so we have these two prongs of this project. Mm-hmm. It's called You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World. And one part is this anthology, which is 50 original contemporary poems, all speaking back to the natural world at this urgent moment on our planet.
Right.
And then the second part of it is that there are going to be poetry installations in 7 different national parks around the country.
Wow.
And that's in partnership with the Poetry Society of America. And one of the best things about that is we've joined the National Park Service with the Poetry Society of America, and that project will continue and
right.
be ongoing after my laureateship.
Okay. Okay, legacy. I love that. That's beautiful. And also, I mean, it's transformative. As you say, it will continue on beyond your tenure. But also, again, it's true to you. I mm-hmm. mean, when I think of so much of your work, I mean, I just think there's a call and response between the self, place, the natural world, the animal, and like maybe we are all animals too, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And I did really want to do something that was authentic to myself. You know, and it's hard because I have many authentic selves.
I love it.
But I really believe in this project, and I'm super excited that it not only got to feature a lot of great voices, but it also there'll be iconic poems in the national parks, which I'm excited about too.
That's so cool. I did want to have One, okay, we've demystified, but we're going to bring the myths back. We're going to bring the myths back for 1 second. One graduate level question, because this actually has been something I've been curious about. It was inspired by a Blue Sky user who goes by Drone Kuzak, which is such a great username.
Great
name. And they wanted to ask about the art of translation.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, and this is something I've wondered. Is a translated poem still the same poem? Or do you consider it something different entirely? Because, you know, if poems come down to word choice, line break, punctuation, I mean, it's really like a detail by detail by detail. And then to translate, you know, a Palestinian poem or a poem from Ukraine, you know, what do you think about it? It's not life or death, to be clear. But what do you think?
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, I've spent a lot of time with translation, and I do think it's different. I think that because our language is how we know how to name things, and we're working with sound work, we're looking for, you know, I always say the poems are the smallest units.
Yes.
We work with the sound first, and then the syllable, then the word, then the clause,
right,
then the line break, then the sentence. Yeah. Then the sojura, then the stanza break. And, you know, so we're working in a very, very, very small unit. And so to make all of those decisions that we make as poets is such an embodiment of our own spirit, soul, blood, all of that. And so to have that translated, you know, when you see that translation, it's very intimate. And I think at closest, it's like it's twin.
Right.
And then oftentimes it's a sibling, like a sister or a brother. And I think that it becomes its own thing. I think it's its own sort of brilliant life force that's meeting the other life force.
Perfect answer. Perfect answer. You should be the poet laureate. We should get on that. I think you're pretty good. You're pretty good at this poetry advocacy stuff. All right, it's time for us to take a quick break, but stay tuned. We'll be right back with your questions for Ada Limone.
Jake from State Farm here, hanging out with Mel's Mow & Grow. Mel chose State Farm for small business insurance because his local agent is a small business owner too. So she knew how to help him personalize his policies. And now, he's rolling in the green. Like a good neighbor. Guys, I'm trying to do the line.
Oh, sorry, Jake.
It's all good. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to an agent today.
Hey there, Zach Stafford, co-host of Vibe Check. And something I heard really early on in my career was this phrase that has never left me. It is, you can't be what you can't see. And for me, that is so true. All of the Black people I got to grow up and watch on television, be journalists, and so much more are the foundation to why I continue to have a media career. And that's the case for so, so many people. And if you're looking for the next generation of influential Black voices in media, you can find all of them on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, listeners, we're back. Zach and I are now going to ask Ada Limone and Saeed some of your questions about poetry. I have a question for you. You know, I grew up in Catholic school. God bless St. James Catholic in Seguin, Texas. But the way those nuns taught us poetry was downright draconian.
Oh, no.
They'd make us memorize poems and then recite them in front of our parents at a poetry recital. That seems like the worst way to get kids to love poetry.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, if you were advising teachers on how to teach poetry to young kids, what would be the one thing that you would tell them to not do?
Yeah. I think the first thing I would say would be to not act as if the poem itself has an answer, that it is not a question to be solved.
Right. A correct answer.
You know, it's actually a mystery, and that it can be read many, many different ways, have many different interpretations. And it might sit and land with someone on an individual level that's entirely different than someone else's interpretation.
I love that. Because so much of the way I was taught poetry was like it was math.
Yes.
Here is a rhyme scheme.
Yeah, it is. Here is the answer. Of math.
This is it. Yeah, I love that. Okay. What is the one thing then that you want every poetry teacher to do with young kids?
I would love for us to talk about feelings. This is going to sound very strange, but like, how does it make you feel? I think that there are a lot of amazing teachers doing incredible work out there. But one of the things that they'll talk about word choice, they'll talk about images, they'll talk about metaphor. But I think that we don't leave space for how does it make you feel?
Yeah.
Mm.
And I think that's really important that, you know, poetry does have an emotional impact, and we've gone too long without giving enough credit to poems for the way they shift our beings.
Yeah. And I would also, just to jump in, to say that one of poetry's most distinct gifts compared to the other forms of literature, which obviously I love too. You know, I write a lot of nonfiction, for example. But I think poetry really works to give language to help us name often ineffable, murky feelings. Mm-hmm. Feelings that you can't get from a newspaper article or even a short story necessarily. And so, pushing students, and obviously it's healthy for young people to talk about feelings anyway, but that's kind of why poetry is special.
Yeah, I think about that C.D. Wright quote, you know, the goal is not to tell a story, but to experience the whole mess. And that is so important, right? We need to experience the messiness of life. And so poetry doesn't have clean answers. It doesn't have a clean narrative. It's about the mess. It's about, you know, the emotional impact. It's about the nuance. It's about making space for complex ideas all in one place, which is how we live, right? That's how we live. We can live with sorrow and grief and rage, as well as joy and as well as love, all at the same time. We do that almost on a momentary basis.
Yeah. I love that.
Well, speaking of mess, I have a messy question for you. Well, really, it's just messy that I'm making myself a part of it. And so here we go. So some people may know this about me. I know Saeed Jones knows this about me. But years ago, I would say, 10 years ago, I was obsessed with Prelude to Bruise, Saeed's first chapbook.
Oh, God, I know what you're
talking about. I famously or infamously would read poems to men on dates from Saeed's book. And I would just pick and choose.
Did it work?
Is that really? It worked, girl. It worked.
Prelude to Bruise. Look, I don't know where it's going to lead you, but it'll lead you somewhere.
It depends on what kind of places.
Date you're trying to have.
Uh-huh. It's a 24-year-old Zach. So, you know, different time, different moment of my life. But that brings me to a question from Heather, one of our Patreon sisters. And she writes, I read a lot of novels. So I'm used to picking up a book and reading it from front to back, ideally in a few sittings so everything is fresh. But is that the best way to read a poetry collection? I feel like there might be other ways that enable the reader to absorb the work better, but I'm not sure what it is. What are your thoughts?
That's a great question.
You know, I don't think there's a right way. It goes back to, I don't think that there's a certain answer to a poem. I like to dip in and out. I like to move into a poem, you know, read one poem, think about it, contemplate it. And then there are times where I think, I love this poem. I wonder what the first poem's like. And then I will end up being like, I just, you know, sat here for 3 hours and finished this book. But I think oftentimes the intent for me is to go in just one poem at a time. I think that the currency of poems is one poem at a time. And if you have the moment and the wherewithal and the heart space and the headspace to read a whole book, more power to you. But it certainly doesn't have to be that. One poem at a time is beautiful enough. And I would also offer to Heather that if she finds that her mind wanders, that is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Poetry says you can have, your mind can wander.
You can come back.
It's supposed to. And then you can go back and read it again because, I just had this whole emotional experience where I was thinking about my own mother and this and that. And then you go back to the beginning, you start again. That is so beautiful. That is not a wrong reading. It's a right reading because it's a soul reading.
I love that.
Well, and it's like we give ourselves that grace with other mediums. Like if I have a podcast on and I missed a thing, I rewind.
Yeah.
Same with the show. Yeah. You're allowed to reconsume, overconsume, whatever you need to get
And you are allowed to skip.
Yeah.
Yes. You're allowed to skip. Yes.
And I think what I love about how you're framing this is that it does apply to other art consumption, because when you find yourself daydreaming, going somewhere else, walking away. I went through a phase where I'd be watching in college. I'd watch these movies with my friend and someone in my program, and I would leave during really tough moments of a movie, and he would always notice it, and I thought I just got bored. He's like, no, you're getting triggered in these moments. So I think what you're bringing up is, you know, the body is communicating some information. So if you find yourself, you know, not finishing the poem or skipping ahead, just listen to the body. That's all data.
Listen to the body.
That's a beautiful analogy. Yes.
Yeah. We have a question from our Patreon subscriber, Alicia, and it's for both Saeed and Ada. She wrote, I always enjoy hearing how different writers structure their days when writing and what rituals or routines they use to get into that creative mode. What does your writing practice look like? Mm. I love this question.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to hear from Saeed, but I know for me, it looks very differently for me when I'm on the road and when I'm home, and I'm on the road quite a bit. I probably travel at least with the laureateship position once or twice a week.
Ooh.
But I wake up, I set an intention. I have a journal. The journal is all things. I used to be very precious about my journal. I thought that I'd have a dream journal and then like a daily journal and then a poetry journal.
That's too many journals.
That's too much. That's too much.
Oh, this is too much. Like,
no.
Also, I was like, this is all one life. This is all one life.
Bam.
Also that.
And so I have notes for poems, you know, and then I'll have like the word like patriarchy and then like, oh, you know, must get coffee. You know, they all sort of go together. Uh-huh, and so I'm constantly taking notes. That's a big part of my day. When I'm actually sitting down with intent to write because I feel something coming on or I have enough notes where I think something interesting is moving in me, then the biggest thing I have to do, and this is difficult, I think it's difficult for all of us, but is to be quiet and to have silence.
Mm.
And I am someone who loves music. I love podcasts. I listen to you guys all the time. I have like all of these things, but for me, it's very difficult to hear my voice underneath the voice.
Yes.
If I am not quiet. And so silence is the biggest tool that will lead me into a poem.
Absolutely.
And that's hard to do because I have Alexa at home and I'm just talking to her all day.
Yeah,
same.
And I'm like, play me some music. Answer a question.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think pretty similar. I think it's important to, I'm going to start calling it a rich between. Like, I think it's important for writers to have a rich between when you're traveling, when you're running groceries, which is to say, 75% of our lives is the rich between.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw you say in the New York Times, you're like, many writers' lives don't actually allow us to write.
Yeah.
So you know, yeah, I mean, even as I was prepping for this interview and making notes, I started making notes on my phone for a poem. In the past, I wouldn't have done that. Yeah, as a student, I used to be very specific and, journal. You know, it was like a ritual, very regimented. And then I was like, baby, you're never going to write if you're setting all these terms and conditions. So yeah, I think it's important to have a rich between. I cannot write on planes. I can't write in really shared public spaces for the reason Ada pointed. I can write like dialogue, even nonfiction, especially if I need to be looking out at the world and observing in prose. I think that makes sense. But poetry, I have to be at home. Mm. Yeah, and intentional. And then the other thing is, and this is true for any type of writing I'm doing, I need to have some sense of aspiration the night before I start writing.
Oh.
I cannot, if I'm just Tab Ross when I wake up in the morning, no idea, no notion, and I sit down, it is a very stressful and actually unproductive experience. I need to, the night before, so like you said, and that's why the rich between is important, some notebook or something that I can pull from and be excited to attempt the next day, I found helps me.
That's so smart. Yeah, I love that.
So our next question is also for both of you. People really wanted to hear from both of you, which is amazing.
Oh my gosh,
the girls. This comes from,
take it on the road. We want to see this live. And this question comes from Jennifer B. She writes, writing poetry usually goes hand in hand with reading a lot of poetry. When writing, do you find yourself being influenced by what you are reading? And how do you keep true to your poetic voice, which, Ada, you just talked a bit about voice. So I'd love to hear your take on this from both of you, actually.
It's a great question. I think that it's very tricky for me. It's one of the reasons I can't listen to music when I'm writing poems. I'm a mimic. I love it. I can hear it. I will do this. And I look at the poem like, oh, no, this is the song, you know? And so for me, I actually do have to have a little space. And so when I'm really writing, oftentimes I'm not reading as much. I'll end up reading prose because I don't like to pull too much. I love to pull some inspiration, yes. But I have to be careful of my own urge to mimic. I don't think everyone else is like that. I just know myself. I'm very sonically inclined. And so if there's a poem that I love the sound of, it's easy for me to be like, oh, this is the kind of music I want to work with.
Yes.
So I often will have to read, you know, prose instead of poetry while I'm really either finishing a book or working at the sort of tail end of editing my own work.
Yeah, basically the same. Particularly with poetry, if it's like research driven, which a lot of my poetry lately has become, like in the archives, I try to read a lot and just build up. And like I said, that rich in between. So I just have like a notebook full of notes, and all of them will not become something. Because when I'm in the writing, I do get nervous. And frankly, even more so with prose. When I was writing my memoir, I was terrified. I still haven't seen Moonlight. Convinced that it was too close. Someone showed me that Barry Jenkins had posted an Instagram of Prelude to Bruges, the cover, is Boys in Water, when it came out. And I was like, too much. This is... I just kind of... Yeah, so I think, you know, because poets, we have such a rich relationship with sound and perception that I think Ada's right. It's a little hard to maybe turn that off. And so... Yeah, even with poets I love, I'm like, I'll have to read that later.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I know we're getting short on time, and we'd be remiss without having you read a little something from your new anthology. Yeah. It's called You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World. It's out now. We'd be so blessed and highly favored
if you read us one of those selections. Bless us.
We need it.
I love that. Okay. Thank you for that, by the way. This is a beautiful poem by the poet Ruth Awad.
Oh, who lives in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
Ruth,
We love.
Reasons to live. Because if you can survive the violet night, you can survive the next. And the fig tree will ache with sweetness for you in sunlight that arrives first at your window, quietly pawing even when you can't stand it. And you'll heavy the whining floorboards of the house you filled with animals as hurt and lost as you. And the bearded irises will form fully in their roots, their golden manes swaying with the want of spring. Live, 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 live. One day you'll put your hands in the earth and understand an afterlife isn't promised. But the spray of scorpion grass keeps growing, and the dogs will sing their whole bodies in praise of you, and the redbuds will lay down their pink crowns, and the rivers will set their stones and ribbons at your door. If only you'll let the world soften you with its touching.
Ooh.
Come on, so just,
wow.
That's it. Yeah, whoop, there it is. There we go.
I had to look away from the Zoom. I started feeling too much.
I love to, as they know, I love to look out the window.
No, when you were saying live, live, so live, beautiful. I was like, oh my God, yes.
The sunlight came out the window.
Wow.
Well, I love it.
With that, we're going to take a quick break. But one thing our listeners really asked a lot about was how to begin reading poetry. And I think we're going to touch on that in our recommendation segment coming up next. So don't go anywhere, listeners. We'll be right back.
Did you know that more than 113,000 children are waiting to be adopted from foster care? Ellie was one of them. When she was placed in foster care at 16 after experiencing significant abuse, she felt unlovable. Thankfully,
Ellie was adopted with help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. Today, she's planning on college and has a bright future. But more than 20,000 teens age out of care every year. You can help. Visit DaveThomasFoundation.org/learn more.
You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
All right, listeners, we are back, and we are here with our best girlfriend, Ada. Just really, yeah. It's our first time meeting.
I was telling you, I think the way I've talked about poetry on the podcast has been hopefully welcoming and inviting, but I was like, trust me, Ada is way nicer and like way better. Yeah.
No, but you have been doing such an amazing job, Saeed. Like can we just say you're just such an incredible reader of poems that I could just listen to you read poems all day.
Oh my goodness.
But we'd love to hear some of the recs you brought. I hear you have some tools for us or some inspiration.
Well, one of the things that you guys were talking about earlier was the idea of how to get started, right? Mm-hmm. And I do think one of the poets that to me was a gateway poet was Lucille Clifton. Lucille Clifton is, you cannot go wrong.
Yes.
And then there's also this incredible book that I love. It's called Please Excuse This Poem. And it's out by Viking. It came out, I think, in 2015. So it's been a while. But it's 100 poems. And they're all just, they're wonderful. And I oftentimes will recommend an anthology with different authors because that way it is like getting a great Spotify or, you know, however you listen to music, whatever platform you use, like a mix, and then being like, oh, I love this one, and being also to skip around. And so that's a really good place to start. And then the other book that I just find so beautiful is Tracy K. Smith's New and Selected. It came out a few years ago as well, called Such Color. And I go back to it often. I just think she's one of our best. And I also find her work very approachable. Mm-hmm. If you haven't spent time with poetry, I think she's a great doorway.
I love you pointing, because I keep thinking about this, creating the occasion so that you can like amass lines or poems or poets you like, and anthologies are great, because it occurs to me, I'm like, for the average, college educated reader, it's like, well, if you only see poems in The New Yorker, then you're seeing one or two isolated poems a month. And if you feel already daunted by poetry, then you open it, you see this one poem.
Yeah.
And you go, I like it or I don't. And that's too much power for one poem. So an anthology is a great way to open that.
Yeah,
up.
And that's one of the things I really wanted to do with You Are Here, was that it felt like, you know, with the legacy of a nature poem in my education, speaking of unlearning things, almost every nature poem I knew was a white man going to a mountain having an epiphany.
Mm-hmm. Very that.
And,
wife was home watching the kids.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And how do I rehome it? And how do I make sure that all of us, you know, feel like we can have a sense of interconnectedness, that we are all nature together on this planet, and that sense can give us all a sense of belonging. That was really important for me, just putting together the project, because that was not the nature poem that I was taught.
My agent still laughs at me. I'll text you the specific tea later, Ada. But in a moment of panic a few years ago, I said, I'm not ready for my daffodils era. I can't.
Wow.
I am not ready.
I think we just gave Saeed a poem prompt.
Yeah, oh no, oh no.
That's the first line of the poem.
I'm not ready. But you're right. It's like, it's interesting. I think particularly queer people, people of color, the way we're introduced to natural poetry, nature poetry, is often like colonizer poetry. Totally. Is actually what's often happening.
And it so is. There's an it's ownership, nice to see you challenging a colonizer that. Mindset. Mm-hmm. There is an idea that this land is ours. you know?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And instead, what is it to be like, oh, I am in a reciprocal relationship with every living thing on this planet?
Absolutely.
There's power in that.
That's such power, such power. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Ada, thank you so much for joining us. This is a dream come true. Oh my God.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank you specifically for your poem called The Contract Says We'd Like the Conversation to Be Bilingual. That one really hits. I love it so much.
Thank you
for it.
Thank you.
All right. That's the show. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Vibe Check. If you love the show and want to support us, please make sure to follow us on your favorite podcast listening platform, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, leave a review, tell a friend, and of course, a very special thank you to our guest, Ada Limon.
Huge thank you to our producer, Shanta Holder, engineer Rich Garcia, and Marcus Hum for our theme music and sound design. Also, special thanks to our executive producers, Nora Ritchie at Stitcher and Brandon Sharp from Agenda.
I was thinking about how to rhyme the last line of credits, but I'm going to skip that. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Let it go. Let it go. Because, as we've learned, of course,
All poems do not have to rhyme. There we go.
Especially if you're writing it and your name is Sam Sanders.
Like, put that finger down. You're pointing real
leave
hard.
Leave that rhyme
put
scheme
that
alone.
Put that finger down, Saeed. Listeners, we
want that rhyme scheme alone.
Listeners, we always want to hear from you. Don't forget, you can email us at vibecheck@stitcher.com. Keep in touch with us on Instagram as well. We have a brand new page that Zach put together because he is a woman in STEM, @vibecheck_pod. Also, we have our Patreon, our Patron, for $5 a month. Get in that group chat with us, patreon.com/vibecheck. All right, poets, till next time, be good to yourselves. We'll see you next Wednesday.
Oh, I love that. All right, poets.
Yeah.
So sweet.
Bye.
Bye.
Stitcher.
From muddy jungle paths to snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder is ready to take you to some of the most phenomenal destinations on Earth. In a Pathfinder, it's more than just the arrival. The real excitement comes from the ride to get there. With 7 drive modes, Pathfinder's available intelligent 4-wheel drive is built for some of the most epic journeys. So chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures in the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. Intelligent 4-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.